Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month's factory collapse in Bangladesh, which killed 1,127 garment workers, put the high cost of cheap fashion back in the spotlight. It exposed slave wages, horrific working conditions at garment factories, and the behavior of brand-name companies whose labels were pulled out of the rubble. This tragedy came on the heels of a fire at another factory in November 2012 that killed 112 workers. The $20 billion garment industry in Bangladesh is the world's second biggest exporter of clothing behind China. Last week, several big brand names, including Sweden's H&M, the biggest buyer of Bangladeshi-made clothes, the UK's Primark and Tesco, and the Netherlands' C&A, signed up to a legally binding code requiring them not just to meet minimum fire and building safety standards, but to also pay for them. A month later, the media have largely moved on, but the problem still remains. And American retailers like Gap and Walmart have refused to sign on to this agreement. In the aftermath of this horrific tragedy in Bangladesh, Avaaz, a human rights group, started putting pressure on H&M with its Crushed to Make Our Clothes campaign. It has gathered nearly 1 million signatures from around the globe, and Avaaz is now pressuring Gap and other brand names to sign on to the agreement. In the new book, Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion, today's guest, Elizabeth Klein, stresses that over the past two decades, Americans have accepted and benefited from the race to the bottom in fashion. The fact is, we are addicted to cheap clothing. The cheaper, the better. How many times have you heard a friend say, "This shirt was on sale for just $10, so I bought five of them"? It happens on a regular basis. And today we are joined by Elizabeth Klein. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Ben Hensler, General Counsel and Deputy Director of the Worker Rights Consortium, a nonprofit that combats sweatshop abuses in the global apparel industry with a focus on factories that produce college logo sweatshirts and T-shirts. Ben has been an advocate, campaigner, and investigator of the rights of workers in the U.S. and around the globe for more than two decades. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the show.
Glad to talk to you.
Great to have you. So, Elizabeth, let's start off with you. I mean, the recent tragedy in Bangladesh has gotten so much media attention. And obviously, this started back in the 80s where we had the Kathy Lee Gifford scandal, the Nike sweatshop abuses. But do you think this latest one is a game changer?
I do. And I think it's a good point to bring up what happened with Kathy Lee, for example, which was in the mid 90s, because I do think, consumers to a certain extent thought that the fashion industry had cleaned up its act and that if we looked behind the curtain, if we really scrutinized what they were doing, that they were doing the right thing. And I think that we just live in different times. We kind of live in this era of conscious consumerism, and consumers really, they don't really stand for corporate misbehavior in a way that we may have in the past. And not to mention just the scale of this tragedy. 1,127 people dead in Rana Plaza. Right. It's just impossible to ignore. It's a tragedy of unprecedented proportions in the garment industry, and I think people just aren't going to stand for it this time.
And Ben, what do you think? Do you think it's a game changer this time around?
Oh, absolutely. I think what's happened here is that it's been exposed that conditions in the industry are much worse than the general buying public had any idea that they were, and that the real cost to workers' lives has been exposed in a very tragic way, and that what has also been exposed is that, as you mentioned, for the last 15 years, major brands and retailers have been telling us they've been doing to protect the workers who make their products, monitoring their factories, having codes of conduct, has been exposed as a complete failure. And so I think this is a real moment where there's going to be a demand for change and where brands are going to have to tell us what they're going to do different in the future.
And it's interesting, Elizabeth, that you said you don't think citizens know how bad it really is and they no longer really stand for corporate misbehavior. What do you think that is?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the precedent that the food movement has set over the last 10 to 15 years. I think that consumers in America are very interested in being able to trace the origins of the products they buy. They know they can get ethically sourced products in other parts of their lives, so they don't understand and don't accept that they can't get that with clothing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even for me, you know, I went around the world researching the fashion industry, and the more that I read about Rana Plaza and the way these corporations sort of set up their supply chains, it's astounding to me. You know, they'll have hundreds of suppliers in a single country like Bangladesh, and it's this very confusing system of contractors and subcontractors. And just as a consumer, when I read about that, I think there's got to be a way to simplify this for brands to take more ownership and more responsibility for the people who are making their goods.
Well, and it's kind of interesting to look at what the media is focusing on and what they're leaving out. And when you talk about what happened at the Rana Plaza, I think that it's really important to focus on the fact that these women, mostly women, were making about $38 a month.
Mm-hmm.
So barely, I mean, just a little over a dollar a day, not even. And the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights, anytime they're interviewed, if they get the time, they talk about the fact that these women knew this building was going to collapse because there were cracks in the building and a bank and other shops actually shut down. But when these women came to the building to find out what was happening, the mm-hmm. factory owner basically said, look, if you don't go into that factory, you're not going to get paid for the month of April and your bones will be broken. So the physical part of this has been missing from most of the coverage. I don't think people understand what these women have to go through. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, I mean, I think that what is so poignant to me about that scenario is that, you know, the pay is so low that maybe a garment worker feels like they literally can't afford to miss a day of work, much less a month of work. And the other thing that was interesting to me about the factory collapse when I started reading some of the stories coming out of Bangladesh is that part of the reason why the building collapsed was because of these very heavy generators and heavy machinery that was in the building. And one thing that I noticed when I was in Bangladesh in 2011, I went undercover as a garment buyer, was that the country just has all of these infrastructure problems. It's a very poor developing country, and there are a lot of power outages. So it's like, the garment industry is trying to modernize, the country is trying to modernize, and brands are putting all of these unrealistic expectations on them. And that's like kind of what's creating this recipe of disaster there. There are so many different factors at play that consumers maybe don't understand.
And I also, a sad reality is that the workers that have been interviewed have said, we're not calling for a boycott because we desperately need these jobs.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, and I've said before that I do think that the fashion industry, in a way, is kind of at the end of the road in terms of they've been jumping from country to country for the last 20 years looking for cheaper and cheaper labor, and there aren't a lot of other places they can go. And also, I think that, you know, Bangladesh, it has 5,000 factories, it has 4 million workers. In that respect, it is a place that could be turned, you know, very realistically, could be turned into a model place to do business, you know, for the fashion industry. And I think that will be the challenge and what hopefully we'll see in the coming years.
And why don't you talk, Ben, a little bit about this race to the bottom? How did we get to a place where we spend more on food than we do on clothing? We spend more on almost every other necessity than we do on clothing.
Yeah. Right. Sorry, Ben, were you going to say something?
Well, Bangladesh is absolutely the lowest cost place in the world to produce garments, and the industry is flooding in there for a reason, because wages have gone up in China, wages have gone up in Vietnam, wages have gone up in Indonesia. And so when you talk about, you know, why do factory managers believe they can't pay workers more than $38 a month? Why do factory managers believe they can't shut down production for a day because if a building is clearly unsafe? Why do factory managers believe that they have to force workers to obey their dictates through the threat of physical violence. It's because of the extreme cost pressure that they're under from companies like Gap and Walmart that are choosing to source there, specifically because they can enforce those kind of low-price demands on the industry in that country. This is being, you know, this is an industry where, you know, the standards are set from the top on down by the price that you're willing to pay, that a brand is willing to pay for a garment, and the date on which it wants to deliver. And, you know, companies like the Gap and Walmart may put on an image of being socially responsible. When it comes down to dealing with factories, they're very hard-nosed.
I hear this a lot. A lot of the companies went to Bangladesh because it's more expensive in China, Vietnam, and Indonesia. But how much are we really talking about? How much are garment workers making in China per month?
Wages, you know, in China are now a couple multiples above wages in Bangladesh. I mean, wages in Bangladesh are something around 24 cents an hour. And so there's, you know, there's a significant price difference between that and other countries. And what's happened over the last decade is that when you take inflation into account, Bangladesh wages have basically stayed flat. The industry has not, you know, given workers any extra breathing room. The brands have not given the industry any breathing room. And in China, they've more than doubled. And, you know, in places like Vietnam and in Indonesia, they've gone up about 50%. So it's really striking the difference in where companies like Gap and Walmart are choosing to move their sourcing to.
But Elizabeth, you're still talking about $100 a month, right?
Well, and I know in China, I went to Shenzhen and Dongguan in southwestern China in 2011, and even then the wages were for garment workers were around maybe like $150 to $200 a month, just if you want to get like a basis for comparison. Like, I think, I know the minimum wage in Bangladesh is $38 a month, but, you know, some workers might make twice that, but that's still significantly less than what people are getting paid in China and in other countries. And I think when I was in China, there were actually Chinese firms, like Chinese factory owners, were moving their production to Bangladesh because it was cheaper. And when I was in Bangladesh, you know, I was there undercover as a garment buyer, so a lot of the factory middlemen or factory owners, that they knew that was their competitive advantage. That was their selling point. We can undercut China. We're the cheapest. I think that there's a real fear there of scaring off Western brands. And that's one reason why, you know, there has to be tougher regulations, tougher restrictions on, and a more direct line of responsibility between the brands and the suppliers, because there's just too much of a power imbalance. When you have this, like, billion-dollar company going into a country that's so poor and, you know, trying to exploit people for cheap labor, you're gonna get something like what we've seen with Rana Plaza.
That is Elizabeth Klein. She's author of the new book, Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. We are also joined today by Ben Hensler, General Counsel and Deputy Director of the Worker Rights Consortium. And it's our Agenda for a New Economy series that we're continuing today by talking about the high cost of cheap fashion. What are your thoughts on this? What changes have you seen over the past couple of decades when you buy clothing? If you work in the retail industry, what do you think about this race to the bottom? How has it affected the work you do? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. And have you gotten caught up in this frenzy? I mean, when you look at stores like Forever 21 and H&M, they're massive stores in downtown San Francisco, and I don't think I've ever seen a sign that's over maybe $30 in these stores in the windows. So have you gotten caught up in that? And, you know, please be honest about it, because let's face it, all of us have at one time said, hey, this shirt was only $15. But what is the cost of that? And what can we do about it? What is the government's role here? And Elizabeth went undercover, as she said, in Bangladesh. She also traveled to China to look at the working conditions. So if you have any questions for her about what she found and solutions to this issue, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. So Elizabeth, you go into great detail, and it's really interesting to read about the history of cheap clothing and just why we became so addicted to it. Can you talk a little bit about that? What contributed to that?
Sure. And I also want to out myself. I wrote Overdressed because, you know, I'm a self-proclaimed former cheap fashion junkie. I was pretty much only shopping at Old Navy, Target, H&M. I owned almost 400 items of clothing, and I was living this double life where I was recycling and riding my bike everywhere and buying organic food. But then when it came to my closet, there was absolutely no reflection, you know. And then I started to look at the tags. Nothing was made in the United States. Everything was synthetic. And I hadn't paid probably more than $30 per item. As you were saying, you know about it, Forever 21 in downtown San Francisco, where nothing is over $30. And certainly you can get a pair of jeans at Forever 21 for $2 on sale sometimes. But anyway, back to your question about how we've gotten to this place. There are a lot of different, obviously a lot of different factors, and it's the story has sort of unfolded over the last 15 years. But I think what's interesting is that it did take a while for us to get hooked on this cycle. You know, it didn't happen overnight. And I think what's interesting, if you look back, you know, into the 60s and 70s, it really wasn't cool to buy cheap. Mm-hmm. People still sort of aspired to own the best thing that they could for their money. And it really took decades for brands to sort of advertise and market us away from owning kind of quote-unquote good clothing. So I think it really took until the 90s and really well into the 2000s before, you know, really like buying ultra cheap clothes became chic. And now we're at a place where, you know, we love it if Michelle Obama, for example, steps out in H&M. That's the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah, and I really appreciate you writing about that. I mean, you also write about Sharon Stone. I think when she went to the Oscars, she wore a Gap shirt.
Right.
And everyone said, oh, look, you know, it's now okay to wear a Gap shirt instead of, you know, a Vivian Wang dress or something. And you also have criticized Michelle Obama because she, you know, with pride will wear these clothing from H&M and Target, for example.
I more so criticize the American public's reaction to her wearing that. Mm-hmm. We have a tendency to claim that that's a democratic thing to do, that that's, you know, that she's sort of like of the people when she does that. But when you really look into how the cheap fashion system operates, there's nothing democratic or fair about it. First of all, these corporations, they're operating on an environmentally unsustainable level. So they're wrecking the planet to produce the clothes that they're producing at the prices that they're selling them at. And the other thing is that they really depend on paying they don't pay garment workers enough to live decently. That is built into the low price. So it's like how, and the other thing is we lost the United States garment and textile trades over our obsession with cheap fashion. So that's why I think it's a little ironic when, you know, we have a first lady wearing, you know, an ultra cheap dress it was probably made on the other side of the world, that we stand there and applaud that.
And Ben, it is amazing to think that in 1990, 50% of clothing in the U.S. was produced domestically, and today it's just 2%. I mean, that is a massive drop. It's hardly anything anymore.
Right.
And the other thing is it's not just that it's not produced domestically anymore. It's about where it's produced internationally. You know, up until 2005, there was a system that sort of doled out quota for importing clothes to the U.S. to countries around the world. And so dozens of countries around the world were able to use this industry as a source of employment in developing countries. And that whole system was stripped away. And so you've seen the industry flood into just a few of the lowest wage
countries in the world. And, you know, and what it means is that the lowest common denominator is countries like Bangladesh, and the lowest common denominator of sourcing practices, which is companies like Walmart, are what are driving the whole industry in terms of their practices everywhere else and everybody else's practices as well.
Do you want to jump in there, Elizabeth?
Yeah, and I think Ben might be able to comment on this as well. I think what's also interesting is, like, you know, a lot of the retailers we're talking about right now, like H&M, for example, they're quote-unquote fast fashion retailers. So they're retailers who are trying to turn their inventory over as quickly as possible, and they always want new products on the floor. In order to do that, in order to pull that off on a factory level, you have to have a lot of very you have to have a large supply chain, so you have to have access to a lot of factories, and it's a much more unstable production process than what we used to see, whereas, like, you know, Nike or even Gap back in the 90s, they basically made the same thing over and over and over again, which means that you could, in theory, have a long-term relationship with a factory, you know, improve conditions there, work with the same supplier for years, but the fast fashion system really breeds instability, and I think it actually encourages, it's like made us move backwards in a lot of ways where brands are just looking for whatever factory will get the order out the door the fastest and the cheapest.
That's Elizabeth Klein, author of Overdressed. We're also joined by Ben Hensler, Deputy Director of the Worker Rights Consortium. Let's take a few calls before we go to break. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. I'm sorry. Let me turn my phone down. I do this to you every time. A couple of things. One, as a very low-income citizen, from receiving Social Security disability, I have to shop at a place like Walmart. My guess is that there are millions of people in this country who have no alternative but to buy clothing at the cheapest place and prices that they can do it. So they're stuck. I mean, and I'm sure this is a large percentage of people if they don't have to go to, you know, outlets like Goodwill or Salvation Army or wherever they can find clothing that they can buy. So, I mean, so that's one side of this issue. People are forced just out of necessity to do that. And I even see people who don't look poor shopping at Walmart. So, that's one side of the equation. The other thing is, even if you could wave a magic wand, and I agree with what your guests have been saying, it's unconscionable what these companies are doing. It's unconscionable that people are buying you know, clothing in these fashionable stores. They should know better, but they seemingly don't care. But even if you could wave a magic wand and raise the minimum wage across the world to $8 an hour, what impact would that have on the cost of clothing, you know, here in the United States? And would people who have to shop at Walmart now even be able to shop at Walmart? So I'm not against increasing the minimum wage or the living wage both abroad and here in the United States. But I think that this is there's a broader issue here that needs, and I'm sure you've covered this. This is just one segment of a broader economic issue, and that is people have to look at a way of coming up with an economic system that is really both healthy and sane and really serves the needs of the people that are having to buy things to stay alive.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
that's why we do this Tuesday show, Agenda for a New Economy, on a regular basis, Greg. Thank you for your comment. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll get to your questions. And then we'll also find out why the Gap's clothing is made in 1,200 factories in 42 countries. I was kind of surprised, very surprised, to read that in Elizabeth's book. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Matt Martin here with Ali Budner, taking 2 minutes in your call to ask for your support on this sixth day of KALW's seven-day spring membership campaign. We are approaching $100,000 to go to our goal, and here on your call, we ask for your support in a challenge period. We have two generous listeners, Terry Carroll and Linda Dardarian, who've said if 20 people will contribute to KALW this hour, they will provide another $1,200 for local public radio.
We have Elizabeth Klein's book, Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. For a pledge of $120, Elizabeth is our guest today. She went undercover in factories in Bangladesh and other places, which is an extraordinarily courageous thing to do. And she is here with us talking about what she saw. And we're hearing it in the headlines about Bangladesh. And it comes right down to what we're wearing on our backs. So if you appreciate these community conversations about how we can live better, please give us a call, 1-800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. You can see Elizabeth Klein's book at kalw.org, as well as other thank you gifts. What I think is important about your call is that, yes, we pay attention to what's in the headlines, but we go beyond them and talk about how we can get involved in our own lives and in our government to make change. And that is what we are asking you to do, to keep this space open for just that kind of programming. Thanks to everyone who's already taken part. Be the next person to call at 800-525-9917 or kalw.org.
Yeah, and this book will really open your eyes to what's going on in this industry. So 1-800-525-9917, a pledge of $120 will get you a copy of this book, and you'll be supporting local public radio.
800-525-9917 or kalw.org. A click is as good as a call. Your support makes everything possible, and in particular, this program locally produced here at KALW. Thanks.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation with Jaron Lanier, author of the new book, Who Owns the Future? You'll definitely want to tune into that. They'll be talking about the impact of technology on our lives and where it's going in the future. Thursday, we'll have a conversation about the effectiveness of strikes in today's labor environment. You may have heard that the Giants baseball team, the concession workers, voted to go on strike. 97% of the workers voted to go on strike. Also today, technical workers at UCSF are striking. So Thursday, how effective are these strikes? And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. And so far, we have tax reporter David K. Johnston booked to talk about the IRS scandal and then also Apple's CEO testifying today about Apple's taxes. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Agenda for a New Economy series. And we are talking about the high cost of cheap fashion. Last month, 1,127 garment workers in Bangladesh were killed. A lot of people are saying this is worse than the Triangle factory fire in New York City. This is happening in the year 2013. You've got brands like Walmart, The Gap, H&M, so many of the brands that I'm sure a lot of you wear. There's a race to the bottom in clothing. So what effect is this having? What are the solutions? Let's talk about that now. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're joined by Elizabeth Klein, author of the new book, Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. She traveled to China and Bangladesh to find out how this industry is affecting real people on the ground. Ben Hensler is general counselor and deputy director of the Worker Rights Consortium. And Ben, what are your thoughts on Greg's call? He, like so many people, live on Social Security, have fixed incomes, and have no choice but to buy this low-cost clothing.
Yeah, I think, I mean, and it'd be interesting to hear what Elizabeth says about this, but I do believe that the shift towards cheap and fast fashion has something to do with the fact that wages in this country have been stagnating for the last 20 years. So I sympathize with that. But it's also important to understand how little a share of what you pay for clothes in a store like Walmart or The Gap actually goes to workers. Our estimate is that somewhere between less than 0.5% and 2% of the retail price of a garment actually goes to the direct labor of the people who make those clothes. So when you talk about could these companies could afford to pay more to the factories and have wages, workers' wages dramatically improved without putting a major bite on U.S. consumers? Absolutely. Absolutely. It's, you know, you could see wages, you know, potentially double without U.S. customers seeing a significant change in the prices that they're paying, unless you see retailers and brands trying to stick it to consumers as a result and trying to persuade people that this is something that's not affordable.
Elizabeth, what are your thoughts?
I have so many thoughts on this issue. It's kind of hard to know where to begin. I think One thing that's interesting is, you know, the reason, one of the reasons, well, I want to say that the fashion industry has always mirrored the American economy. So when you see really high splits in high and low fashion, so super overpriced clothes that no one can afford, and then really cheap stuff that no one can afford or that everyone else is wearing, that usually tends to mirror the American economy. So that's what we've got right now is, you know, the 1% and then the rest of us. And, you know, that's really connected to the loss of manufacturing jobs and garment. And, you know, we've lost the garment and textile trades. They've been the fastest, one of the fastest dying industries in the United States over the last 10 years. And then the other thing is, I do think that there's a little bit of maybe dishonesty with American consumers when it comes to how they spend on clothes, because we actually spend the least percentage of our income on clothing than we ever have. It's 3% of our income on clothes. So I think there's kind of been a devaluation of clothing where we don't see it as something worth spending a lot of money on. And, you know, I certainly, like my sister and I always compare what we're spending on clothes. And it's really interesting. Like, I might drop a lot of money on an iPhone. She drops a lot of money on her cell phone or her car payment. But both of us are sort of reticent to spend more money on clothing. Hmm. So I do think there needs to be maybe a little bit of an adjustment in our thinking about clothing, because I think right now we really value quantity over quality, quantity above everything else. Like, Americans are really stockpiling a lot of clothes, and I think that that's even true of people who, you know, who are maybe saying, I'm shopping at Walmart because I can't afford better. But I think all Americans, regardless of what income bracket we're at, are love the, you know, 3-for-1 tank top deal, for example, at Walmart or Target.
Right. Well, we have a related call, so let's hear from Alex in San Mateo. Hi, Alex.
Hi. Good afternoon or good morning, everyone. And I just want to say thank you so much. I feel like I'm really learning a lot, and I feel like my eyes have been opened, and definitely a topic that maybe doesn't get addressed enough. And I think people kind of choose to maybe not think about it. And then others of us really haven't thought about it and haven't been informed. So I really appreciate all the information.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to say, and kind of piggyback, although you, I think, Elizabeth, you kind of just started answering my question, I just wanted to see if there was any suggestions or advice for people who kind of are like me, getting their eyes open to this and saying, okay, so we, you know, I know I'm on a budget, I know I have a single mom, two kids, you know, but how can I not continue to contribute and let that be an excuse? And I think you're kind of saying, well, maybe, you know, instead of, you know, needing 12 tank tops in 12 different colors, maybe you have 3 or 5. And I mean, but, you know, but I mean, that kind of makes sense, because going back to what you said earlier about like the 1950s and 60s, and, you know, my grandmother was hardly wealthy, but she was dressed to the T, and she did. She had her like 5 really nice suit and to go to church on Sunday or to the grocery store, you know. And anyway, mm-hmm. So if you have anything, and maybe your expertise and your kind of what you've been studying and looking at, that would be wonderful advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that that's a really, you know, it's a great question. It's a good point. I think that one of the kind of most dynamic or interesting things about being an ethical fashion consumer is that there's so many different ways to participate. I mean, in light of what's happened in Bangladesh, the onus is on the brands right now to really offer an ethically made product. I want to be able to walk into an H&M, for example, and know that if there's a tag that says made in Bangladesh, that doesn't mean that, you know, that person was working in bad working conditions. I think that there should be, you know, a fairly made corporate fashion product. But that said, there's so many other ways that you could change your shopping, whether it's going, you know, shopping in thrift stores or participating in clothing swaps or simply shopping less. I mean, for me, I kept a lot of the clothes that I had before I wrote the book, and I just get more use out of them. You know, I've kind of gotten out of that disposable impulse method of shopping and try to think a little bit more long-term about my purchases.
Also, what are your thoughts on locally made clothes? Because I'm wearing a vest today from a company called Cut Loose, and it's in the Mission District of San Francisco. They make their clothes here in San Francisco. This vest is a really nicely made vest. It was only $30 on sale. And then I also shop at a place called Blue Canoe. They do organic, like exercise clothes and undergarments and things. And then there's another one called Fair Indigo. Fair Trade, when they have sales, I mean, you can get stuff for $20, $30. You just don't need a lot. But, I wonder, that doesn't do anything for these women in Bangladesh, right? So how do you deal with that?
Well, I think that we need to stop thinking of this whole issue in terms of scarcity. The fashion industry grows every year. I think there are enough jobs to go around, meaning that we can certainly grow the industry in the United States, and we can still improve the industry in places like Bangladesh. What we need to see is fair trade and living wage products coming out of Bangladesh. And, I think that the domestic production is actually coming back as well. And that's another reason why these brands are going to have to figure out a better way of doing business overseas, is because a lot of people's response to what's happening in Bangladesh is like, oh, I'm just going to shop American made, I can't do this anymore. I'm just going to buy the locally made option. So I think that that's another reason why this is going to be a real turning point for corporate fashion, because there are so many amazing, small, ethical, domestically made fashion brands coming up. I mean, you just mentioned, four or five that you know personally, and every city in the United States has a sort of like indie domestically made fashion scene now.
And Ben, what would you add to that? I mean, what can we do other than I will never shop at Walmart or H&M again and, try to find good clothing at some of the and not as much clothing at some of these fair trade companies, because they do exist. And some of them actually outsource overseas, but they have these stories about women that are treated well. They pay for their education, their housing. But Ben, I mean, what does it help to buy from that? Does that send a message, or does this have to be a governmental response?
Well, I think there's two things. One is, in the wake of the tragedies in Bangladesh, companies are making real choices about what they're going to do and what they're not willing to do to save workers' lives. And consumers can make choices about where they're going to shop in response to that. H&M, Inditex, the company that owns Zara, Abercrombie and Fitch, all last week committed to a binding agreement where they would take responsibility for making sure that the factories where they produce the bulk of their goods in Bangladesh are made safe. And the Gap and Walmart have refused to sign on to that agreement. Consumers can make decisions and can communicate with those companies in response to those kind of choices that companies are making. The other thing is that we can support a different kind of model where U.S. companies are making real commitments to make sure that, A, the factories where their products are being made have good working conditions, respect workers' rights, and that they're willing to pay for that. I'll just give you an example from the industry we work in, which is the collegiate apparel, university logo sweatshirts and T-shirts. There's a company that is a major player in this industry, Knights Apparel. They compete with Nike in making college logo sweatshirts and T-shirts. They opened a factory in the Dominican Republic, pays a living wage, did not contest workers organizing a union, has a safe and healthy working environment. And those sweatshirts and T-shirts are carried in college bookstores around the country, including at the bookstore at Cal over in Berkeley. So there's a different model of doing business that's out there if these brands and retailers want to adopt it.
And Elizabeth, you actually visited that unionized factory, Alta Garcia, in Dominican Republic. Just quickly, how did that factory differ from the factories you visited in China and Bangladesh?
I mean, it's just total transparency. I could have conversations with the garment workers. I went to some of their homes. Like, people from Knights Apparel wanted to talk to me about it. The union representatives, it was just like a total open book. And the other thing is, because those workers were making a living wage, they were actually able to save up to send their kids to school, for example. Like, one of the women that I met had just added two or three extra rooms to her house, and this is to say that her family, you know, her family of like five was living in a one room house before. So the you know, the increase in wages was making a huge and very clear difference in their lives. And perhaps what's most amazing about Altagracia is that the company, they don't pass those costs on to the consumer. The product is pretty much the same as it would be if you were buying a Nike collegiate sweatshirt. That is a really fantastic model. And I remember when I left the Dominican Republic being like, well, I can't imagine the rest of the industry ever doing something like this. And in the 2 years since I've been there, I've seen more brands wanting to take that kind of responsibility. Like, I know that Eileen Fisher, for example, went on record recently saying that they're thinking about opening and owning their own factory. Hmm. So it is actually an alternative that brands should consider.
That's Elizabeth Klein, author of Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. And Ben Hensler is deputy director of the Worker Rights Consortium. And let's hear from Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Thanks for holding.
Hi. yes, I find all this really disconcerting. One thing I wanted to say is I am absolutely furious at companies like Coret, especially, you know, big in San Francisco, because they are, in quotes, such a philanthropic organization, and yet what did they do? They closed all their factories in the United States a number of years ago and moved to Mexico, and they may even be someplace cheaper by now. And, you know, they have such a good reputation as giving so much money to the museums, et cetera, and yet they refuse to pay their American workers a living wage and move someplace cheaper. And there's a number of companies like that.
Was this called Claret?
Pardon me?
What is this company called?
Coret. You've never heard of Coret?
Coret, no.
There's the Coret room at the De Young Museum.
Oh,
and,
okay.
Everything else. And I think companies like Coret should really be held accountable that, you know, on one side they do all these supposedly philanthropic good works. On the other side, they refuse to pay decent wages. And I mean, for that matter, Walmart is always, you know, touting.
Oh, ow. Sorry about that. Yeah. Are you still there?
I'm still here, yeah.
Oh, Nancy? No, Nancy's gone. Well, it's interesting. I had no idea the Coret Auditorium, Coret, had that history. Ben, I mean, here in the Bay Area, you know, the Gap is the same thing. And when you're looking at a company like the Gap, you know, a lot of people wonder, how can they pay more? Do consumers have to pay more? Well, what about the profits? They posted $14 billion in revenue in 2010. Mm-hmm. And their clothing is made in 1,200 factories in 42 countries. And Ben, didn't you have a story you wanted to share about Levi's? Oh, I think we lost Ben.
We've lost Ben, too.
Yeah, okay. Sorry about that. But Elizabeth, what are your thoughts on that? I think Nancy raises an interesting point.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I think that, you know, we've seen... What do I have to say about? I think that, I mean, what's interesting to me about Gap is that over the past couple of years, even since I finished writing the book, Gap has been so busy trying to rebrand themselves because they keep getting squeezed by H&M and Zara. They keep getting squeezed by the fast fashion companies. So they're trying to reposition themselves as a more fashionable company. And it makes me wonder, you know, they're one of the American companies that's dragging their feet on signing this fire and safety agreement in Bangladesh. And I wonder if it's just because there's a lot of confusion over there about where that company is headed and, you know, how they're going to continue to grow as this corporate giant. And you know, Zara, I think, is actually they're the owner of Zara is, I think, like the fifth richest person in Europe or something now. He's so wealthy, and there's so much profit being made in this industry. And that's just yet another reason why the low wages and, you know, the low percentage of the retail price of the goods that's going to labor is really inexcusable. It'd be very, very easy to increase the wages paid to garment workers without passing that on to consumers.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Nancy. Sorry we lost you there. Let's go next to Rebecca Burgess in Geronimo, who runs the Fiber Shed Project. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on. And I just wanted to thank both presenters with so much work they've put into establishing transparency. It's really refreshing to have this awareness brought to everybody. And I just wanted to shed some light on how the face of manufacturing changing from these more regional models that we used to have where we produced in places where we also consumed to these whole countries, you know, like 86% of Bangladesh's exports is textiles. 52% of the world's textiles are made in China. And I just feel like when you change the face of the globe to whole countries now functioning to service whole other countries' consumption practices, you change the face of the way the country that consumes looks. And an example of that is we're throwing away close to 1.5 million pounds of wool every year in the Greater Bay Area. Sheep farmers don't make a living off of raising wool animals or wool-producing animals. So to me, we're changing the bucolic, beautiful pastoral settings of our cherished homelands because we're not valuing fiber farmers anymore because the production is all overseas. And so New Zealand is now the biggest wool producer in the world because they're closer to the Chinese manufacturing centers. So you see how we change how agriculture works, we change how we manage landscapes, we change the way the jobs are distributed, the types of jobs people can get. Everything's service industry and high tech now in the Bay Area, but there could be an agrarian re-stimulation like we're seeing with the slow food movement around fiber. And so my organization is working on that very job of tasking people with the designers who are graduating. We're trying to connect them to farmers, and we are doing a feasibility study to do something with that 1.5 million pounds of wool. And we hope to see the reemergence of a California fiber industry where we're producing cloth from our own farmed materials and offering that to local designers.
Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for calling. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we are slammed with calls, and I just want to make sure we get a few more, and then we'll get final thoughts from our guests. Thanks again for calling in, Rebecca Burgess, who runs the Fiber Shed Project. Let's go next to Bruce in Monterey. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I just want to mention that I think, as it's been alluded to by other callers, that a lot of the problem goes back to the whole way the whole workforce is structured in the U.S., and we have people making basically 1970s wages in 2010 and having to pay twice as much as any other country for medical care, four times as much for transportation, where we don't have mass transportation in this country. You start looking at ways to save, and one of those is shopping at a Walmart. And I understand that a Walmart sucks jobs and sucks money out of local economies, and it is certainly employing slave labor overseas. So I don't shop there, but I can afford that. I know other people can't. And a fundamental change in the garment industry that's taken place over my lifetime is where it shifted from the north, where it was union, to the south, where it was non-union, and then overseas, where unions have no, take hold, and also you have no pollution or labor laws or anything else.
Yeah.
But what's made that possible is the whole infrastructure of the U.S. and the laws. Germany is quite a contrast, because there they have a German Works Constitution Act, and workers, by law, have to be part of the management of the company and participate in decisions, which include shipping jobs overseas. So they haven't lost manufacturing jobs. Over the last 40 years, they've grown manufacturing jobs, unlike the U.S., where we've lost 2 million in the state of Ohio alone.
Right.
So it's when you ship manufacturing overseas, it's done by intent. Because you do that, you have no oversight by any U.S. law.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's the race to the bottom. I mean, $38 a month. Elizabeth, you briefly touch on this in your book, talking about the role U.S. trade policies play in all of these cheap goods. And what happened with NAFTA? I mean, immediately the clothing companies jumped the fence and set up shop in Mexico.
Yeah, but I don't want to close the conversation.
Well, we have a few minutes. I have a positive question in a couple minutes. We do have a few minutes. So just address that, and then we'll end on a positive.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true, but we've also seen, the resurgence of domestic manufacturing. You just had a caller calling in talking about, rebuilding up the domestic fiber industry. So we are at a turning point, and that is one of the reasons why consumers are paying so much attention to Bangladesh, because even leading up to that factory collapse, there was already a clamoring for an ethical fashion movement. There was already one underfoot, and I think when that tragedy happened, it just pushed people over the edge. They said enough is enough.
And so ending on a positive note, Ben, colleges have done a really good job of pressuring the school to stop buying from sweatshop companies and, you know, starting, for example, the Alter Garcia and the Dominican Republic to buy from those factories. In just about a minute or so, how did they do that successfully, and how can that translate to the broader movement? I mean, we're getting a lot of emails from people saying, what can I do here?
Yeah, well, I think what's really significant about the model that colleges adopted, and it's really been driven by their own students as well as sympathetic administrators and faculty. You know, there's 180 universities and colleges which are affiliated with our organization, including the whole UC system, is A, make the companies that wanted to use their logos, like Nike and Adidas, make a binding commitment to workers' rights, write it into their licensing agreements. Number two, make it transparent. Make those brands and retailers disclose the factories where their goods were being produced. And, you know, number three, put an emphasis on where you find a problem. Don't just move to another factory. Actually correct it, you know, and make sure that both workers are compensated for, you know, the harms they've suffered and that conditions are going to be better in the future. That's why the agreements that companies like H&M and Inditex, Zara, Abercrombie & Fitch signed last week is so significant because it's taking the same model to the industry as a whole. It's a binding agreement. They're going to commit to inspections, which are public, of the factories. And we're really hoping U.S. companies like the Gap and Walmart are going to join in and really be industry leaders in the same way.
We are out of time, but we will definitely continue following this. Ben Hensler is with Workers' Rights Consortium, and Elizabeth Klein is author of Overdress. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for listening.
I'm Matt Martin here in the studio with Rose, and we are in the day six of our 7-day spring membership campaign here at KALW, the penultimate day when we are going to be asking for your support, and we want to end this Shorter is Better drive as a success. I know that your call listeners are some of the most committed people supporting this station, and now is a time when you can help us push over an important goal to get below $100,000 to go in this campaign. But we need to start the calls and the clicks right now at 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Rose, there's a challenge.
Yes.
20 calls or clicks by the end of this hour, and we are at 12. So be the next person to call. Help us get an additional $1,200 for local public radio.
800-525-9917. This is day six of our Shorter is Better campaign. You can also go online to KALW.org. For $120, we'll send you a copy of Overdressed by Elizabeth Klein, an excellent book looking at the issues that we addressed today. I loved Alex's call. My eyes have been opened. I'm learning a lot. At the end of the day, that is our goal. And to also talk about solutions, if you appreciate a show that really believes in solutions and action, give us a call, 800-525-9917. 20 calls, we'll get an extra $1,200. Thank you, Terrence Carroll and Linda Dardarian in Oakland, 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
We've been having people call and give $25, $50, $300. We've even had a $500 contribution today. At every level, you make a difference in helping us make it towards this challenge and toward our big goal. It's about everyone coming together to keep this station strong, but we've got just 2 more days in this membership campaign. There's no more time to wait.
And we've got just 1 minute almost left right now, so give us a call at 800-525-9917, because as you know, we are not cutting into content. You can also go online to KALW.org. $120, we will send you Elizabeth Klein's new book, Overdressed. Your call is here to have these conversations, to talk about solutions, and to talk about how we can take action. Support that kind of radio. It is so important right now. 800-525-9917. You can also go online, KALW.org. We can get 20 calls or clicks. We'll get an extra $1,200, which goes a very long way, at KALW.org, 800-525-9917.
I see that we have an open line right now, 800-525-9917, KALW.org. A click is as good as a call. One of the guests today said we're at a turning point in this discussion. And I think what's important about having a resource like Your Call and like KALW is that at these turning points, and we could see this when the lines were just lighting up, people wanting to get in on this discussion, that we have a place to spread information and talk about constructive action. That's what you support when you make a call. 800-525-9917. We'll send you Elizabeth Klein's book if you like. That's a $120 contribution. But at any level, you will make a difference.
800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Support a show that also believes in revisiting these issues.
Sometimes,
the rest of the media says, all right, that's done. We say, wait a minute, what happened with that fracking bill last month? What happened with this issue in Bangladesh? Support that kind of programming. 800-525-9917 or online, KALW.org. It's day 6 of our Shorter is Better membership drive. If we can reach 20 calls or clicks, I know we can, we'll get an extra $1,200. Thank you, Terrence Carroll and Linda Dardarian in Oakland. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
We are listening to KALW San Francisco, where in 15 seconds we will be going to the BBC in London. Your support makes it all possible. KALW.org. 800-525-9917. 800-525-9917.
Or online, KALW.org. And thank you for your support.
Thanks.